Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.
Have you been seriously injured? Mama Justice is here for you. Our medical team partners with top-notch doctors, surgeons, therapists, and urologists, ensuring a comprehensive recovery journey. If you've been injured, call Mama Justice today. We're here for you.
It's time for True American Heroes, For the Record, with Jack Rutland. Another exclusive on Super Talk Mississippi 102.1 FM. Many of our heroes have taken their stories with them to the grave. But this show is about the stories and personal experiences of these veterans.
Well, welcome. We're honored today to have with us a gentleman that's going to be no stranger to many of you, Coach Alton Ricks, who was at Copiah Lincoln for a long time. He was actually there while I was there, but we're actually very honored to have him here. And today we're going to be talking about his military experiences in World War II. Coach, it's an honor to have you with us.
It's an honor to be here.
Well, let's get right into the program, because there's some interesting things that I know people are going to enjoy hearing about your experiences. You actually came into the war later in the war because you were young when it started, but I believe it was in November of 44 when you actually were drafted and went into the Army.
That's right.
Okay, so you were a Mississippi boy. You were living up in Northeast Mississippi.
Prentiss County, a small community named Wheeler.
In Wheeler, basketball country.
That's right.
So you were up there. You got your notice, and they allowed you to finish high school because you were still in high school when you got your notice.
Right, Jack. After I had my physical, we had a few weeks off, and then when I came back, I was in my second semester at Wheeler, and they let me finish early. To get my diploma before I went in service.
Also let you finish out the basketball season.
Oh, yeah. We played about 55 ball games that year.
You probably won a state championship or got close.
We were third in the state on 43-44 a year before. We were third in the state. You know, about there were about 600 high schools then, and they weren't any division at all.
Mm-hmm. That's right, back in those days. So you are in the Army. Where'd you end up doing your basic?
I did my basic at Fort McClellan, Anniston, Alabama.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this question, because I love to ask a lot of the World War II vets. Do you remember where you were, what you were doing when you heard the announcement or someone inform you that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor?
I was a 14-year-old up in Northeast Mississippi, and I was going into the ninth grade at Wheeler. And the next morning, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, we had one radio up there. Mm. We plugged it in, and we all listened to his proclamation at the Imperial Nation of Japan. It attacked us, and we were ready for the World War II.
Do you remember your thoughts and your emotions, your feelings? What were your friends saying? What was going through your mind?
My first thoughts were, I had a brother that was already in service.
Oh,
he was 12 years older than I. And I said, well, the war will be over before I'm 18. You know, that was my thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't the case.
Goodness. Your brother was in the World War II?
Yeah, he went through all the Pacific area.
Okay. All right, let's get you got your basic training, and you ended up as in infantry.
Right. Jack, we went through, they referred to us as Marine Infantry, and about 12 weeks of infantry training, and we had to go from the basic M1s on up. The BAR was my specialty. Each patrol had a Browning automatic rifle, and I was the one chosen in my patrol to handle the BAR.
Well, now, somebody told me one time that a BAR, which is an automatic weapon, and it's pretty larger than the M1, but somebody told me that when you pull the trigger on a BAR, all you did was hold on.
Well, you're true. It held, each magazine is 20 rounds, and if you touch the trigger, it would fire about three times. And you could not carry enough ammunition. You had another soldier to help you carry ammunition.
That's right. It was a two-man team.
Yeah, but the good thing about the BAR, it was easy to clean and keep up. It didn't have as many parts as the M1.
Okay, okay.
We had to do it without looking, you know, at night and keep it clean and so forth.
So you finished your training. You're in an infantry unit, Marine, which meant you were moved, not the Marines, but you were a Marine Army designation.
Right.
And you guys, where you went by ship.
Well, that's true. But first it was geared for in close fighting. You know, they knew the war was over in Europe. And by as a result of the Iwo Jima and Okinawa experiences, we were hands-on close in. We had to be knowledgeable in several weapons. The BAR was one, but the bazooka, the flamethrower, mortar, and things like that. We were trained in all of those.
And a lot of hand-to-hand combat training.
The bayonet was on our rifle at all times.
Wow. Okay, so you finish your basic, you finish your training, your designated training, and then you're given an assignment and you're given orders. And what were those?
Jack, let me go back just a bit. The last week of our maneuvers, live maneuvers, word got to us at night that the bombs had been dropped in Japan. At that time,
atomic bombs.
At that time, the sergeants lost control of the soldiers just about because there was an eruption. We had been out for live maneuvers for about 4 or 5 days. And immediately that was cut down, and we were loaded on trucks and hauled into the camp, and we were immediately prepared to go to the Pacific, you know, for occupation.
Sure.
And I got to come home for about 3 days and then get on a troop train in Tupelo and head to Monterey, California at Fort Ord, California.
So now you guys are facing a different thing. You've been training all this time before the atomic bombs were actually dropped, the two of them, one on Hiroshima and one on Nagasaki.
Right.
And you were thinking that we're going over there and we're going to hopefully not have to, but the reality was the Americans were facing an invasion of the nation of Japan itself.
As we were expecting it in November for the invasion of Japan in November, and we were in what was IRTC. And the question they asked, what did that stand for? And they said the R would be replacement. We would replace those casualties. And that caught our attention.
Yes. It was the casualty count was estimated to be...
Well, it ought to have 500,000 body bags.
Wow. Well, and you can debate all you want the decision that President Truman made, but I think it saved hundreds of thousands of American lives.
I assure you, he's on my team. That's my favorite president. I assure you that because...
But now you've been changed. Your mission now is from combat to occupation.
Right.
So you go to Seattle, am I correct?
Right.
And you get on a ship.
Troop ship.
And a converted Liberty ship.
Liberty ship, right.
And you're in there with about 4,000 other sardines.
That's right. We felt like a sardine. That's right.
Okay. But you go the northern route, which is up through the Aleutians and Alaska, correct?
Right.
And actually, how much time did you spend at sea?
We were on 15 days aboard this troop ship before we got to the harbor of Nagasaki.
Okay, then interesting. We're going to talk about that. The fact that your first stop was at Nagasaki, where the atomic bomb had been dropped just a few weeks, 6 weeks earlier?
Right.
Okay, so, but the ship trip, the travel across the northern Pacific up through there, any experiences other than being cramped?
I was fortunate. I didn't get seasick. But there were many of the soldiers got seasick. We had to carry our helmets with us at all times. We ate twice a day, and we had to get in line whatever we did. Of course, the helmet was used for two purposes. Mainly, if you got uptight and you had to vomit, you use your helmet. It was quite an experience aboard ship with that many, you know.
Troops. Were there enough berths for everybody below deck?
Whatever the berths, you had to fold them up. When we got in our compartment, you had to get in your compartment where the other soldiers could get in. And then when you got out, you had to fold up. Each bed had a hinge on it, and they would swing up. They were about four deep. You had to climb up, you know, about four levels.
The man at the top was pretty high up in the air.
Yeah.
I hope he didn't walk in his sleep.
Of course, we had our duffel bags all were attached to the end of our bed. We had each one of us had a duffel bag.
Did you actually carry your weapons with you then, or did they issue weapons?
At all.
Okay. No weapons at all.
Not at all.
Okay, so you make the trip through the northern part of the route. over to Japan and you end up at Nagasaki. Now, that's interesting because you guys knew the bomb had been there, but nobody really understood radiation and steam fallout and stuff like that. So you guys didn't go into the port because Nagasaki was a city that had a port. It was a major port.
Right. It was a rather large seaport.
So your convoy, I don't know how many ships, if you remember, was it a big convoy?
Only one. We're a Lone Ranger.
Okay.
Only one.
So, I mean, your guys were specifically to be used for occupation. That's
right.
What your assignment was for
right.
those 4,000 men. So you get to Nagasaki, and you didn't go to the dock. You stopped, anchored
out.
Dropped anchored out off.
A mile
off
or so outside.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't see the city.
Not at all. You could see it outlined, but you couldn't see anything about the city.
But I'm sure you heard reports that the devastation was unbelievable.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you were there how long?
3 days before we moved out to Nagoya.
You think there was a possibility they were thinking about putting you guys out at Nagasaki and then change their mind?
Well, that's what we thought. You know, we didn't know. You know, you don't know anything when you're a private in the Army. And but we didn't have tents, and we didn't have – there were no buildings, you know, so it was –
probably a really good thing that they moved you guys up.
It wasn't a hard decision to make.
Right,
so,
sure.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're leaving Nagasaki. Your ship gets underway. And where do you guys go then?
To another port named Nagoya.
Nagoya.
Which is about a half day's travel by ship.
Okay.
Something like that.
Okay. And you get to Nagoya, and what happens?
Go ashore.
Okay.
And
you're on Japanese soil.
Japanese shore, and we got on a troop train. And several hours, we came to another larger city, inland city named Kobe. And that's mm-hmm. where we had, mm-hmm. they had barracks there, military barracks, and that's where we stayed for a few weeks.
So we're almost to our break, but this is really getting interesting because now we're talking about the nation of Japan, very militaristic. Their emperor, they worshipped, and you are now an occupying force, and we're going to get into a real interesting discussion about the people. That's what I think our listeners will be interested in, your interaction and some of the things that you experienced. Because you were in Japan how long?
From late September of 45 until May of 46.
Wow. Well, we're honored to have with us a World War II vet, no stranger to most everybody in Kapai and Lincoln County, former Colin basketball coach, Mr. Alton Ricks. And we'll return for the second half of our program in just a moment. Well, welcome back. We're honored to have with us today Mr. Alton Ricks, who is no stranger to the community, known by many folks, a successful coach at Colin and teacher for many years. And we're thankful that he decided to stay in the fair city of Wesson. And so many folks that I go to church with speak highly of you, and I've seen you many a time at porches, but I've never had the honor of meeting you, Coach. But it's a treat to have you with us today.
Jack, it's an honor to be here.
All right. This has really been interesting in hearing you share with us your experiences in World War II, because you're giving us a different perspective. Most of our veterans have shared instances involving combat or in support areas in all of the different wars our country has found itself in. But you're giving us a perspective of being in occupied Japan after the war, after the surrender, and you're actually boots on the ground, face to face with people who just a few months earlier were sworn to fight to the death. So it had to be an interesting experience. So,
yes, it was, Jack. I was fortunate, again, not being in combat, but they were defeating nations, and their civilian population was in dire need of many things, food, for instance, clothing and many things, fuel. Mm. And we were there certainly as an occupation force, but we were there to support them to a certain degree, but still there was a degree of hate because
sure.
of war and what
and
it
many
transpired.
Of the people, yeah, many of the people you guys came in contact with had lost family
sure.
members,
yeah.
sons and husbands, and so there was a lot of something other, hatred, whatever
yeah.
you want to call
yeah.
it, that had to be worked
yeah.
through. Now, I have to say, it's been my experience in the history I've read that I think a lot of positive things came from the occupying force because of the attitude. We weren't in there like shall we say, the Russians were in Germany abusing the people, taking such terrible advantage of them. You guys weren't doing that kind of thing. You had specific, and tell me what you were saying about the instructions you were given.
Well, Jack, we had our carbines loaded, and we walked, you know, and after about 2 or 3 weeks, ammunition was taken up. We didn't need ammunition.
There was no threat.
We were told there'd be a sniper behind every tree and all that, but we never did know of any problems that we had in the occupation of Japan.
So you disembark, you're in Japan now, and you're assigned to a particular city, or how did that work?
Well, we worked out of the cities. We'd go out in the areas and pull duty. I remember one morning about daylight, this fellow soldier and I were dropped off in a small community of the town, something like the size of Weston. And we were to stay there for 10 hours. Just walking the streets.
Just the two of you?
Just the two of us. No way to communicate with anyone.
And what did they tell you they actually wanted you to do? Just walk around and be seen?
Be seen. We won the war to be seen. And we did have contacts. Some of them came up and talked to us, and the mayor came out and talked to us, and we had no problem whatsoever. And it was quite interesting to us to see their lifestyle, know that they were living under some pretty severe conditions during the war.
So many of them could speak English.
Oh, quite a few could speak English, right.
So tell me about, you were sharing a moment ago about the mayor.
The mayor invited the private and I in for sake at 2 o'clock, and we did not go. We were instructed not to participate in any social activities. We had about the only thing we knew to say is Wakatama Sin, which means I don't understand what you're talking about.
The ones that spoke English, did you have any conversations with them that really were more than hello, goodbye, you know, anything like that?
Well, not really. It did not go in any depth at all. It was just speaking, sometimes they'd ask us our name or something like that, and where we're from. Some of them knew something about the United States, you know,
really?
Geography of the United States. But it did not go in depth at all, as far as a conversation.
Let me ask you this. What about the children?
Well, that's one thing that the children would follow us around. If we had chocolate in our pocket, they call it chocolito or chewing gum, in the hopes that we'd drop something off. And I didn't smoke. My friend didn't smoke, but sometimes they would like to have cigarettes or something like that. Candy would attract. If you dropped a piece of candy on the ground or anywhere, that would attract a mob of youngsters, a mob of them.
I know that Japan was training very young children to prepare for battle. I was just curious as to whether or not you saw any of them exhibit anything that looked like
not at all,
anger.
Jack. Not at all. We did not have anyone that showed any degree of harm to us as troops, as occupation troops.
Awesome.
Right.
Well, you were also talking about the city where you guys were bivouacked. You actually had a fire.
Right.
And
the building, we were out on duty one day, and we looked back, and our barracks had burned down. It was wintertime, and we used alcohol to heat, grain alcohol, and somebody turned over a stove up in our building.
So it wasn't the Japanese.
No,
it was just an
not
accident.
At all. It was natural. It was natural. It happened, right.
My goodness. So you did this through the winter, actually.
Right, through the winter, right.
Does it get pretty cold in Japan?
Oh, yeah, we had plenty of snow up there. When we moved up in the Yokohama area, up in the mountains above Yokohama, we were close to Mount Fuji. We could see the mountain, Mount Fuji. And
I understand it's beautiful.
Yeah, it is. It was snowy, and right. Mm-hmm.
Neat.
And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was there for several weeks, and this was what was referred to as the Japanese West Point, the buildings were. And that's where we did our...
It was their military school.
Right, mm-hmm. And we were able to travel. I was able to go one... friend of mine and I decided we'd catch a train, go to downtown Tokyo. And on each train, you had a car that was supposed to have been for the U.S. military, but we didn't see that car, so we just pushed in among the Japanese, and we rode that train down to downtown Tokyo and went to Emperor's Palace and a few other places. How we got back to our company, I don't know yet, but we got back. We didn't know how.
So you actually saw the Emperor's Palace?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And do you know if he was even there?
We assumed he was there, but we had no. The Japanese were coming up and bowing down, and worship.
Yep. Right, yeah. Right. So apparently he was there.
Apparently he was there.
That's interesting because he was allowed to keep his position as emperor in the surrender agreement. But you actually, you know, I'm just a little bit surprised that they were able to turn off, because toward the end of the war, they were the kamikazes, they were doing such horrible things and fighting to the death. And yet, it's here we are just a few months after the war. They're able to switch it off.
Switch it off, completely peaceful.
That's amazing.
Back to Tokyo, Ernie Pyle Theater, I was there, 8th Army headquarters, and we were able to visit in those areas on my trip.
Ernie Pyle Theater.
That's right. And I've read all of Ernie Pyle's books.
Well, now, you got to tell us, because many people don't know that name. Tell us who
he
Ernie Pyle
was. Ernie was a war correspondent all the way through Europe. And then he went to the Pacific, and he was killed by a sniper on Palau Island, riding in a Jeep there after the island had been taken. It was one sniper there. He was accidentally shot, killed.
Great correspondent, wrote many great articles, and was a favorite because he actually went on a lot of missions with the GIs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been fortunate to read all of his books, and he was a very interesting.
Well, he told it like it happened.
He lived among the soldiers. He lived in the dugout.
Sure did. Awesome. Yeah. Okay, so there was a couple of things. There was one thing about the arsenal. You were going to tell us that story.
The first night, I was assigned along with another soldier in a large building, which is the arsenal, full of bombs and explosions and so forth. And we were pretty nervous that night. We spent the night looking around, and the only thing we were told, just don't let anyone come in and bother you. Let me go back to basic training. One thing is fun now, but we had an infiltration course we had to go through.
Right.
And this machine gun was set up to fire 36 inches off the ground, and we had 50 yards. It was at midnight to crawl directly into that machine gun
36
fire.
Inches.
36 inches. And every fourth bullet was a tracer.
Oh, my word.
And
a tracer is one that glows when it's fired to help
exactly
the machine
right.
gunner.
And we crawled at about 50 yards, and in that 50 yards, you fell over in a tunnel, and that means you'd finished your 50 yards. And that was quite interesting.
That's live fire.
That's live fire. That was quite interesting. It sure was. And,
unbelievable.
That was
training.
That's kind of like digging a foxhole, letting the track of the tank run over the top of it. You know, you dug it deep. You sure did.
Oh, my word. I didn't know about that.
We did that in basic training. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, getting back to Japan.
Yeah, back to Japan. You actually ended up assigned to guard duty at a prison.
That's right. That's right.
Tell us about that.
Well, we'd go down and take shifts, you know, day and night, 24-hour shifts. And we didn't really know who was in there. We knew they were the leaders of the Japanese Army, Navy, and so forth. And that was about the limit of what we knew. We were just down there to keep anyone from coming in, anyone going out.
Coach, how old were you when you were in Japan?
I was 18.
What was it like for an 18-year-old a long ways from home on the other side of the world in a really a dangerous part of the world? What was it like? What was the emotion? Did you write a lot of letters? Did you spend a lot of time in prayer? I mean, what was it like?
Both of those, Jack. And it was kind of a scary place for a while, not knowing what's going to happen tomorrow. We'd read and heard so much about the atrocities the Japanese had performed,
right?
But we found that wasn't the case at all, and we soon got to the point that we changed, mixed in with the civilian people without any fear.
Did you have any that you called a friend?
Well, they would do our washing and do our help clean our barracks. There was no problem as far as meeting.
Amazing.
Not whatsoever.
Okay.
But those people were starved. They were hungry. And whatever we had in our mess kits, you know, they'd take it for food.
Now, you're getting close to the end of your tour in Japan, and you caught another troop ship, headed back to the States.
That's right. Kind of interesting. When I got the message to get aboard this military truck and go down to the embarkation place. There was about 300 of us in this large barracks. And they called us out and started to call off the names. And then you called your name off, you picked up your duffel bag, and you got in line and got aboard ship. They got down to the last one, and they didn't call off the name. and I was the last one. And I and you know, he didn't say much, but I said, "Sergeant, you maybe missed one." He said, "Soldier, going back in the barracks. We get you tomorrow."
Oh, my word.
So I was the next first one on the list
The next day. You were that close to being on that close. Ship out. Yeah.
I caught the next ship, though.
So you were out the next day, headed home. You were telling me about a typhoon that you guys got.
Well, going over, we got in a typhoon going over, and
you were telling me about how rough it got.
Bow would go down, and the motor, we could hear the prop turning in the back, popping on the water.
It came
up, and the water would come up on the bow.
Now talk about seasick. I bet that created a little bit of seasickness.
A lot of seasick soldiers sure did.
Incredible. So you're back to the States. You end up in Seattle, and they send you.
Well, we came back in L.A. We came back. We
didn't come
back. Came back in L.A. Mm-hmm.
And then you went from there to Camp Shelby?
Camp Shelby, and got discharged.
Okay. And I think it's so neat. We got to just tell this story. You went from Camp Shelby getting discharged. You probably went home.
Right.
And then you went where?
Well, about 3 weeks, I came to Kapaa Lincoln to play basketball and go to school. I had to reverse that a little bit.
For your first cousin.
John Ray Ricks was my coach, and he had been he was a naval commander of a destroyer in the Pacific.
Wow.
And went through several battles.
Wow. Wow.
And he was my coach first year, and his brother, Arliss, was my coach second year, and he was a captain with Purple Hearts in the infantry in the Philippines.
And that coach, Ricks, taught me at Hines Junior College, never mentioned his military experience or his sacrifice.
He did not talk about it. But,
amazing.
But we knew.
This has been wonderful, Coach. I'm grateful for you coming up here. You know, all of our vets, as they came home from World War II and the other conflicts, they were looking to go home and start their lives. And I'm so grateful that you, Alton Ricks, ended up at Kapaa Lincoln and stayed in Wesson, because there's so many people think so highly of you and the way you serve your community up there. But I'm also want to say to you, thank you for your service to the United States of America and your role that you've played in World War II, because every role was important.
Jack, I appreciate those nice words, but I don't think I deserve them. I've listened to the soldiers talk about their experiences and how they were much more difficult than mine. And during the actual combat.
Well, let me just say this. I've never talked to a vet that thought he was a hero or thought that he did anything, but everyone had a role. Yeah. And you're part of the American greatest generation that helped our country come through a terrible, terrible time.
It was my opinion, is the right thing to do, to serve in the military.
Thank you for that. It's been an honor to have with Mr. Alton Ricks from the Wesson community, a veteran of World War II, part of the greatest generation. And this concludes our program.
A Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.